Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lendman. My guest today is Frank Barat. Frank has been on before, some months back. He's a member of the UK-based Solidarity Campaign. He's also a member of the organizing committee, Russell Tribunal on Palestine. And you can pretty much imagine what its agenda is, seeking justice for the long-suffering Palestinian people, something I make no bones about. I support it absolutely strongly, write an awful lot about it, and I always will. Frank is also the editor of a new book. I think it's fairly new. It's called Gaza in Crisis, Reflection on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. It's by Noam Chomsky and Israeli historian Ilan Pappei. And we have an awful lot to talk about during the hour. The Russell Tribunal had its second session last November, a London session. Before that, it had a Barcelona session addressing vital issues concerning the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So we want to talk about that, and we also want to talk about what's going on in the Middle East right now. And, my goodness, I took a count yesterday. I drafted still another article this morning, my 11th. My 11th since the 16th of January. I'm astonished myself. I can't believe that. I've covered an awful lot more than just Egypt. I've covered what's going on everywhere, but Egypt absolutely is getting the headlines today, and well, for several days, and it's made me very, very suspicious. But Frank, let me welcome you, and we can get into the discussion. Where should we go first, London session or Middle East?
I think it's a tough one, because obviously what's happening in the Middle East and in Egypt today and in the last few days is really amazing. So we could talk about the London session briefly, because I think that if we start talking about the Middle East now, we might just, you know, eat the odd hour very quickly. So we could talk about the tribunal for really like five, ten minutes, and then move on to what's happening in Egypt and Tunisia, if you agree, of course.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. Once we get started on what's happening right now, it'll be impossible to turn it off, because we could keep that discussion going all afternoon.
Of course, yeah.
Take 5 or 10 minutes and explain what went on at the London session last November.
Okay. The whole goal of the Russell Tribunal, as I explained in the show a few months ago, is about third parties' responsibility and complicity in the ongoing question of Palestine and violation of Palestinian human rights. So we're not focusing, at least for the two sessions, we didn't focus on Israel violations, which have been established and documented by many reports and UN bodies. We're focusing on who is letting Israel, who is financing Israel, and who is letting Israel run amok and violate all those resolutions, violate international law without any accountability. So we focused in Barcelona about the EU, so the European Union, and in London we decided, because of the BDS boycott, divestment and sanction movement, we decided to give people, the citizens, some food for thought. So we decided to focus on corporations benefiting from an illegal situation. Because, as you probably heard many times, people in Europe, people in the US, people all over the world often say, Israel, Palestine, there's nothing to do with me. You know, it's about Muslims and Jews. You know, there's nothing I can do. And it's obviously completely the opposite. And that's why the tribunal is focusing on third parties, to show people that their governments, the corporation they buy their mobile phones from, or else are complicit in this conflict and could actually, taking them to account could, get things to be a lot better in Palestine. So that's the focus really of the tribunal. During the London session, sorry.
Oh, I want to. Oh, let me let you finish up on London, Frank. But as you wrap up that discussion, explain when the next session will take place. But let me let you.
Okay.
Continue.
So I'll wrap up because the next session is very interesting. And so the London session focused on corporations. We wanted to prove that if, for example, the wall. The apartheid wall cutting through the West Bank and eating most natural resources in the West Bank has been deemed illegal by the highest judicial body in the world, International Criminal Court, Court of Justice. If the wall has been deemed illegal, if you are for an Irish company called actually CRH, Cement Rodstone Holdings, helping building the wall by providing cement, you are also complicit of an illegal act. That's the question of if a bank robbery is committed, if you're driving the car, you're complicit. So that's exactly what we proved in London. So lawyers, again, jurists, activists came, gave testimony about what's happening on the ground, gave very solid information, solid facts about corporations' involvement in the settlement, in building the wall, in the arms industry, and showed that international law should do more about the role of corporations, and that we can, in civil or criminal court, take the CEOs of those companies to account, take them to court. It obviously costs a lot of money, but we can also let the shareholders of the societies know that what those corporations are involved with and change things. So that was the focus of the London session. The next session, we're sort of changing and going back to Israel and the main culprit. We are going to focus, and we're going to hit Israel where it hurts. We are going to focus on is the crime of apartheid that, the convention for the crime of apartheid was established in 76. So apartheid is not only related to South Africa, it's actually now a crime, an official crime. Is the crime of apartheid applicable to Israel's treatment of its Palestine population in the West Bank, in Gaza, but also in Israel itself, because 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinians. So that would be the focus of the South Africa session, and trust me, it's going to be the most explosive session so far, because if Israel hates something, is the word apartheid and the word racism. So we will you'll hear more about us in the coming few months. And the next session should happen in South Africa end of October this year.
What do you have a date for the session, Frank?
We don't have a date yet. We should have a date in about 2 weeks, because I'm going to South Africa very soon with my colleague to decide on a date. But so yeah, end of October. Probably like the last weekend of October, something over 3 days. But we will have a date in the next 2-3 weeks maximum.
Oh, I really look forward to when the session has been held and results come out, and you report about them. I wrote about the Barcelona session, and I also wrote about the London session. So for certain, I'll write about the South Africa session. And to talk about the issue of apartheid and do it in South Africa, what more appropriate a place to do it than there?
That's obviously what we picked South Africa for.
Oh, absolutely. So important. Among the 11 articles, including the one I have today that hasn't gone out yet, Frank, I wrote about Al Jazeera releasing the Palestine papers. Well, it didn't tell me anything I didn't already know, except the gory details and direct quotes. They were always interesting. But the PA, the Palestinian Authority, run by President Mahmoud Abbas, whose term expired 2 years ago this month, so it really is over 2 months ago. I forget the exact date, in January 2009. I think it was fairly early in the month. maybe the 10th of January. So he is over 2 years past the expiration of his term, hasn't called new elections. Of course, he's strongly supported by Israel and by Washington. He's their enforcer. And the Palestine Papers were on the bogus peace talks. I call them the no-peace peace talks that have been going on for an eternity. Before Oslo, I mean, they go back at least to the 1980s, and they never were intended to go anywhere, because the one thing Israel will not tolerate, or Washington, is peace. They need conflict. They need to show that they have enemies. So it really, it was great stuff, the Palestine Papers coming out. A few comments on them, Frank. I mean, it's terrific that this came out.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And I think actually that's the bigger picture. The bigger picture is, okay, I mean, the PA is corrupt. The PA collaborates with Israel and the U.S. But the bigger picture is that, you know, however big the concession from the PA are, and what we learned from the Palestine paper is that the PA was ready to make the biggest concession it's ever made without obviously consulting its people on Jerusalem, on Haram al-Sharif, on the refugees. However, no matter how big the concessions are, Israel just says no, which proves that Israel is not interested in peace, because the concessions we've learned about in the Palestine papers are huge, really. And so, I mean, in my opinion, what the PA has done in response of those papers is such a big mistake. They, instead of shooting the messenger, what they've tried to do, the PA attacking Al Jazeera, etc., the PA should take those papers, should take the Goldstone report, should take the ICJ advisory opinion on the wall, and, you know, create this huge, maybe PR campaign or something to prove with the facts that Israel is not interested in peace, and then move on and stop those, again, bogus, you can't call them peace negotiations. So, you know, they should have used those papers, you know, to their favors, but they didn't, which proves, again, how corrupt they are, and how not interested themselves in the people they are. And I think that, as you mentioned, Abbas is not president of Palestine. His mandate expired more than 2 years ago. But also the PA itself was supposed to be a temporary body for about 5 years, and I think the PA mandate expired in 99 or something, which means that the PA shouldn't even exist anymore. It should have been completely reformed and recreated. So the Palestine papers don't teach us some, very new things, but now we've got facts, solid facts and solid proof that what we knew for so long is happening.
Oh, exactly, Frank. I mean, the scoundrels have literally been caught red-handed, exposed, and you read the direct quotes that this character, Saeb Erekat, is the latest in a long line of so-called chief peace negotiators. Mahmoud Abbas had that role leading up to the Oslo Accords, and that was a sellout. And very sadly, as Edward Said, when he was alive, pointed out, Arafat was very complicit in going along with this. And I can remember the first time that I wrote an article about Oslo. I called the Accords. He was in exile after forced out of Lebanon in 1982, Israel's invasion and war that killed maybe 20,000 people, mostly Palestinians, a lot of non-Palestinians as well. But it was just a ruthless slaughter, and Aristide's on my mind for another reason. Arafat was exiled with, a lot of his people to Tunisia, to Tunis, and I call the Oslo Accords his get-out-of-Tunis-free pass. I mean, he wanted to come back. He wanted to be boss again. He didn't just want to be just another bigwig sitting in Tunis, not really able to do very much. And so he got to come back, and he got a photo op on the White House lawn. I will never forget that moment as long as I live. Clinton and Rabin, Israeli Prime Minister, and Arafat. And it was a pretty sickening display. And I quoted Edward Said several times on his brilliant comment on just what a disgraceful exhibition that was, and all of the players, and Bill Clinton as the impresario over these two vassals that Israel got everything it wanted, the Palestinians got absolutely nothing, and they called it peace. Well, it was no peace. Everything quieted down for a while until it heated back up again. Sooner or later, people realize that they have been cheated again, and they simply will react. And here we are today, all these years later, and there's no peace, and there's no intention on the part of Israel and Washington of negotiating it. And the Palestine papers make that very, very clear.
Yeah, of course, and I'm going to totally agree with your explanation about, you know, even Arafat implications, because I guess people tend to idolize, you know, the dead, and since Arafat died, he's been idolized a bit, and this is wrong, because even if he started as a fighter, etc., he ended as corrupted as Abbas and the rest. So, facts should remain intact, really.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And then, of course, you remember at the end of his time, he what was the last negotiation he took place in? Was that at Camp David? The one that he simply could not accept. When he negotiated with Ehud Barak, now Israel's defense minister, but Barak demanded concessions that were even too much for Arafat, and he knew that if he ever went along with basically was absolute exposed unconditional surrender, that the Palestinians would never let him off the hook, and very possibly his own life might be in danger from his own people. So he simply could not accept the most outrageous agreement with nothing really in writing, no maps, no nothing, but it was nothing short of exposed unconditional surrender. And then Israel targeted him as a traitor. You remember when they were bulldozing his headquarters in Ramallah?
Of course. And that's, again, the point is you cannot negotiate when you've got nothing to negotiate with, and that's what's been the whole charade about actually the whole conflict. Even calling it a conflict is misleading, because it makes people believe that there is two parties, there is some sort of two equal sides negotiating about a land or something, but it's not. It's not a conflict about, you know, whose land is this. It's a colonialist conflict, an imperialist conflict with one very powerful country, you know, colonizing the indigenous people, and that's why we need to reframe the conflict, and that's why negotiations. And it's been proven. I mean, how long? I mean, they've been negotiating since the 90s, so it's like more than 10 years now of negotiations. And when you look at the facts, and that's why, you know, I've got friends and people I know that works for the PA, etc., and they tell me, look, we're trying our hardest, etc. But you have to wonder, like, either they're naive, or they're in it for their own, you know, business, because 10 years, I mean, long, but I mean, at least 10 years of negotiation. And what did they get? What did the Palestinian get? Nothing. And in fact, they lost a lot more. Now the Palestinians are a lot weaker than they were 10 years ago. They lost more land than they had 10 years ago. They lost more people than they had 10 years ago. They lost more civil liberty than they had 10 years ago. So at one point, when is going to come the time when the PA is going to say, look, 10 years of negotiations have brought us strictly nothing, and actually we've lost a lot more than we had 10 years ago, and we should stop. How long is this going to continue? It sounds really ridiculous to me for people that I'm sure are very intelligent to continue this charade. And even after, I mean, continuing the negotiation after the Gaza massacre of 2008 and 2009, so when you saw, let's see, someone in Gaza who had lost both his legs, his whole family, his house, his work, and seeing Abbas, his, you know, president, shaking hands with Olmert or VP Livni or Ehud Barak or Netanyahu. It's such a slap in the face. It's just a slap in the face for the victims. So this charade should really stop now, and hopefully it will.
Oh, absolutely. I refer to the Abbas government as a coup d'etat government because it certainly wasn't elected. Abbas, in theory, was elected president, but I remember writing about it at the time, and Israel literally rigged the election for him to win it. It just made it impossible for the opposition. There was one leading opposition candidate, and they broke up his public meetings, delivering addresses to supporters, and they basically rigged the election to have their guy become the president. And of course, he's gone over 2 years beyond the expiration of his term, and the prime minister, who was elected to nothing, I wrote an article recently on him, Salam Fayyad, calling him Israel's man in Palestine. Well, he represented, when he ran in the 2006 elections, he represented the Third Wave Party. The Third Wave Party, that was the election that Hamas won very, very convincingly to be the official government of the Palestinian people, not just of the West Bank, not just of Gaza, but of the West Bank, of East Jerusalem, all of occupied Palestine. And then we had the coup Washington and Israel supported that created conflict, and they supported armed Abbas and Fatah to take on Hamas and try to dislodge them from Gaza. They failed. So we have a split government. Hamas controls Gaza, and Fatah controls the West Bank. And you've got this character, a former IMF World Bank official, whose party in the 2000 elections got all of 2.5% of the vote. 2.5% of the vote, and he's prime minister? Well, I mean, if that doesn't smell like a rotting fish, I just don't know what. And, of course, he's Israel's man. He's not the Palestinians' man. And this is what the Palestinian people have to put up with. As you mentioned as well, Frank, that the expanding Israeli settlements, including East Jerusalem and the West Bank, 500,000 Jews settled on stolen Palestinian land. And they keep building more settlements. More expanding the settlements, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, I can't really add anything to this. I totally agree with your analysis. Mm.
Well, it's a very sorrowful situation. It's one that I cannot get off of, and it's a frequent topic on this program, Frank, and it will continue to be, and that's why I love having you on, and eagerly look forward to getting you back after the South African session so we can talk about that. Shall we move on to other interesting events in the Middle East? My article today, I'll even mention the title. I'm very suspicious about what's going on, and there's no question. Well, the focus, of course, is on Egypt, and it should be, because Egypt is the most important Arab state, and it's certainly the largest. It's Washington's most important strategic ally, after Israel, of course, and so that's getting the headlines. But number one, I scratch my head and I say, why is it getting headlines at all? Because really, to U.S. audiences, you have the BBC in London, and the BBC covers world news. I'm a severe critic of the BBC because, number one, it's owned by the U.K. government. So Neri will say a nasty word about its own government, except a little wiggle room around the edges that it gets. But it basically supports the government that signs their paychecks.
Yeah.
I mean, they better. I mean, when they stray too far, they not only sacked the reporter who did it, and there was one case I remember so well. I forget the man's name offhand, but there was one reporter who went a little bit too far criticizing the government. Not only did he get sacked, but the entire BBC management was sacked. I mean, it was really astonishing. I mean, you just don't go that far. But anyway, it amazes me. We're in the U.S., in the U.S. especially, U.S. audiences really get any overseas news unless America is going to war or has a foreign enemy it wants to vilify, then you will get reports. You will get a lot of reports. But typically, you get virtually nothing. It's like the rest of the world doesn't exist. And there's a saying in America, Frank, that that so many people in this country learn geography according to what country America next attacks. Before the Iraq War, before the Afghanistan War, if you ask people, where are these countries located, the majority would have given you the wrong answer, or they just would have said, I don't know. And now, you know, 2003 Iraq, 2001 Afghanistan, if you ask them again now, there's very little in the news about both these countries. It died down, and it really isn't there very much, so they probably again wouldn't know. You would have to have the conflict heat up again before their memories would be reawakened. So here we have major stuff going on in a number of Middle East countries, Algeria, Yemen, Jordan, Tunisia, and of course Egypt. Well, the only one getting attention in America, Lebanon as well, because Hezbollah is taking control of the country. At least that's what the reports are. They don't have a majority of delegates, but in one way or another is a Hezbollah-led government. So that got media attention. I haven't seen much lately because it's all Egypt that literally has wiped most of the rest of the news off the air, which is astonishing. It is absolutely astonishing to see something like this. So I'm scratching my head, Frank, and I'm saying, not only that, but on our media, what is absolutely unheard of is going on. Pro-opposition Mubarak forces, their views are being aired. Well, I mean, that tells me one thing. I do believe, I can't prove it, but it strikes me that to put opposition forces on air and let them say what they don't like about the Mubarak regime means that they are supported by Washington. And my new article for tomorrow is called Revolutionary Change in Egypt, Internal or Made in USA? And I don't have a smoking gun to prove the latter, but I honest to goodness believe it's made in the USA. Any comments?
I guess that's an interesting thought, and I haven't had the chance to, think about it for long enough, because the news keep coming in like every hour, it's sort of changing, and from what I see so far, I mean, it seems to me that what's happening in the Middle East and in Maghreb, in Tunisia, is that those oppressive and repressive regimes that have been supported, financed by Western powers, France in Tunisia, actually the French, I think it was a French foreign minister, recently said in French news that Morocco and Tunisia are a matter of domestic policy for France, which was, and no one noted, and which was amazing to say this, it's not. You're not a colonial power anymore. Tunisia and Moroccan affairs depend on Tunisia and Morocco, nothing to do with France. But the way, for example, in Tunisia, Ben Ali, I mean, Sarkozy was in Tunisia about a year and a half ago, shaking hands with Ben Ali, saying, we are friends of Tunisia, we support Tunisia, etc. And now Ben Ali sort of lost this, there's been sort of kicked out by his people, and France completely, abandoned him. They even refused him asylum in France, which is really sickening, because they are the puppet masters, the Sarkozy, the Obama of this world. But, Stephen, should we continue later? Because I think the music is coming on.
Oh, yeah, the music means a break. Yeah, they would not give Ben Ali, the former 23-year-long despot of Tunisia, a former French colony, they would not give him a safe haven in France. But in 1986, they gave the infamous baby Doc Duvalier safe haven. And then they flew him back to Haiti, and I wrote a few articles on that. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Elaine Schnupper, host producer of Evolving Ideas. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E at GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
On with Frank Barat, talking about occupied Palestine and current events in the Middle East. If Washington is behind the ouster of Mubarak, Frank, it will not have been the first time, because there have been a lot of former despotic allies that suddenly lost their usefulness, and Washington simply abandoned them or got rid of them. And this is the way I begin my article for tomorrow, that I say U.S. imperial policy includes regime change affecting foes as well as no longer useful allies. And I mention only three, former Philippines leader Ferdinand Marcos back in the 1980s, given safe haven in Hawaii, but he didn't last very long after that. Iran's Shah. Washington was behind the 1979 revolution. That will come as a great shock to most people. And one that will obviously not shock most people is Saddam Hussein, who was a close ally in the 1980s until he fell out of favor. And we got rid of him, of course. First we had the Gulf War, which didn't get rid of him. But we certainly punished the Iraqi people all through the 90s. And then he went a short time after 2003. And there have been others, and some we may not know. We may suspect, there are suspicions that maybe Dr. Valier had mentioned, there are suspicions that Washington was behind ousting him in 1986, because after 16 years, he lost his usefulness. So we simply got rid of them. We didn't kill them. We don't usually do that. We usually just get rid of them. Just get rid of them from office and then get a new face in to continue old policies. And the policies are very much the same. Unbridled U.S. imperialism, corporate predation without restraint. This is really what it's all about. And, of course, now it's worse than ever, Frank, where America's goal is unchallengeable global dominance. You go back some decades, and it might have been more regional. It wasn't quite as all-embracing as it is now. But now the policy is literally global dominance with no allowed challenger. And when one crops up, then America does whatever is possible to defuse the challenge. If the challenge is too great, you don't want to go to war with somebody who can bomb you as easily as you can bomb them. But it's easy to pick on soft targets like Iraq. I don't know that Iran is such a soft target. Iran certainly cannot bomb the U.S., but Iran is a stronger country than Iraq. But a lot of them are pretty soft, and it's easy for a bully, which is what I call America, Frank, to beat up on somebody who simply cannot put up an equal fight. And that's what America does, and that's what Israel does. They will not pick up. They will not pick on an adversary that might give them a whooping, rather than they be able to give their target a whooping. So they stay away from them, and they go after the soft targets. But I think that Mubarak may have well outlived his usefulness, and he was targeted for removal. And it could come any time. I mean, it could come today. It could come sometime next week. It might be in a week or two. Who knows? But I think he is absolutely a goner, and I hardly see a chance at all that he will remain in power. But the fix is in to put in new faces to continue old policies.
Well, what's that?
Go ahead, Frank. Frank? Oh, dear. Were we disconnected? If that's so, Jason, if you could get Frank back on again. Frank, if you're connected, please just jump right in. I'll continue it. I'll continue the discussion until I get you back on again. But this dirty game has gone on a number of times before, and whenever it happens, the major media are complicit. So I notice, as I mentioned before the break, that the media seems supportive to some degree of opposition forces. They are putting on air, they're interviewing people representing the opposition to Mubarak. I mean, they just don't do this kind of thing. There never was anybody allowed on air to support Saddam Hussein. I mean, there never was somebody from Iraq supporting Saddam Hussein. There were occasional critics of going to war with Iraq showing up on U.S. TV. But they were outnumbered maybe 100-1. But they're absolutely, in the run-up to that war, at least a year in advance, there was never one single voice supporting the regime of Saddam Hussein. But there are quite a number of voices supporting the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. That just doesn't happen unless the message is clear. The Obama administration supports his ouster because he's been around for 30 years. He's 82 years old. He's in ill health. He's become damaged goods and expendable. So you get rid of him. It's like trading in an old car for a new one. That's what they're doing. They get rid of getting rid of an old model to bring in a new one, and whether they will do it with names that are being floated around now, a new prime minister, a new vice president for the first time in Egypt's history under Mubarak. Frank, are you back on again? Oh, I wonder if I'm on. Well, I'll keep this going until somebody tells me otherwise. I hope I haven't lost my connection. I'm checking emails now. Let's see. I've got an email from Frank. Oh, he says not sure what happened. He got disconnected. Let me send him an email and saying trying to reconnect and hoping I'm still on the air because I'm still talking. Jason, if you can hear me, and if I'm not connected, please send me an email and let me know. Otherwise, I guess I'm talking to myself, but maybe I do that once in a while as well. But again, strong point. Follow the message on the U.S. media. Follow the message on Western media for listeners in Europe, the BBC especially, but also the other major media in Germany, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, other news services. If they seem in any way supportive of something that you would think they would never go for, they are expressing the views of their government. Otherwise, they would never do anything like this. So I think Mubarak is on the way out. The U.S. media is playing it up big. They're showing what they never show. If they were Mubarak supporters, they would never do anything like that. But they're supporting huge crowds in the streets in major cities across Egypt. And there are other odd things going on as well. The repressive Mubarak police force, security forces, after being on the streets and murdering people and beating them and tear gassing them, for the last couple of days have been absent. They are not on the streets. The military took their place, and the military has been very quiescent, really acting supportive of the people, not there to put them down. There's been a curfew imposed for a number of days. The people there have ignored it. Nothing is done to deter them. They're on the streets, round the clock. The numbers ebb and flow. Smaller, of course, overnight, past midnight. Early in the morning, they tend to be very, very light. Today is a work day in Egypt. Crowds were very, very light early in the morning. And I believe now they have gotten very, very large, again, in major cities, Cairo, Suez, Alexandria, and many other cities you don't hear about, not mentioned in the news. But the big cities, people are out there in force. And the military, so far, has basically just stood by, has done nothing to deter them. Something is rotten in Cairo. Something is indeed rotten. I go over it. I discuss it in my article. It'll be out tomorrow. It'll be on my blog site that, again, I invite people to, listeners, to check out. There's new stuff going up on it all the time. It's all by me. I keep it only to store my own articles. Steve Lenman blog. Google Steve Lenman blog. You'll see all my articles. This will be my 11th one since the 16th of January. On the uprisings across the Middle East, including the Palestine papers, including Tunisia. I have never, ever written about Tunisia. I did it for the first time, wrote several on Lebanon, because that is major, major news. Hezbollah basically taking control of the Lebanese government, and I certainly don't believe that's what Israel and Washington wanted. Unless they want a cause celebre to go to war again with Lebanon, then having a Hezbollah government would be a casus belli to start another war. But Hezbollah really treated the vaunted IDF very roughly last time. And I believe they will give them a good massaging this time as well, although Israel for certain has new tactics. Frank, are you back on again? Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I have not been clued, so I do not know if I am on or not. Jason, clue me. Clue me if I'm on. Well, I will keep this going. I will not stop because this is very, very major stuff. And it's so important that, I don't ever want to be disconnected on any programs. But I've got to send. let me send an email to my studio. There are uprisings that have occurred in a number of countries around the Middle East. I mentioned them. Lebanon was an electoral transition. And there's potential trouble brewing there as well following the Hezbollah takeover because its man was appointed prime minister. There was a day of anti-Hezbollah protests on the street. The supporters of the Saeed Hariri government. Saeed, the son of Rafik Hariri, the assassinated prime minister in 2005, there is a tribunal convened, a UN-backed tribunal, to blame it on Hezbollah. Hezbollah had nothing whatsoever to do about it. You always ask Ki Bono when something happens. Hezbollah gains nothing but trouble from assassinating Hariri, so obviously they didn't do it. At first, Syria was blamed. Well, they also had everything to lose and nothing to gain, and they did lose because they ended up withdrawing their forces from Lebanon, giving Washington and Israel more direct control, which is exactly what they wanted. And there's no question who was behind the assassination. It was Israel's Mossad. And I wrote a very detailed article, including a lot of history of Mossad and all of the people they have assassinated and the reasons. And there were times in the past where they were fingered. They were caught red-handed, and they were fingered, including by Western governments naming them as being responsible for murdering people, either shooting them, poisoning them, car bombing them to death. Hariri died by a car bomb. Absolutely a Mossad operation. Classic. Absolutely classic. I mean, that should have been the immediate reaction, but of course it wasn't, because Israel can do what it wants and gets off scot-free. Anyway, there's that going on, and then we had the initial uprising in Tunisia, supposedly set off, and whether so or not, I don't know, supposedly set off by a young student who couldn't find work, set up a vegetable fruit stand in a Tunisian city. And the security forces tried to shut him down because he didn't have a permit. And he couldn't get a permit. They wouldn't give him a permit. And he needed to find some way to bring in some money so he wouldn't starve to death. He was so upset by this story that I reported. I hope it's true. He was so upset by this that he self-immolated. That was the spark that set off the whole country, supposedly. So many days later, the 23-year-long despot Ben Ali is out of the country in a safe haven in Saudi Arabia. I'm sure Mubarak already has his safe haven picked out. That got practically no attention in the U.S. media. So that attracts my attention. Does that mean that Washington is not happy about this? I don't know. I honest to goodness don't know. But I can't imagine Washington is happy about protests in Jordan, protests in Algeria, protests in Yemen. Although there's a leader in Yemen who isn't the most dependable guy. He's been around, I wrote about him, over 20 years. And he has a lot of conflict that's been ongoing in Yemen for a long time. And CIA forces have been on the ground there for many, many months, stirring up their own trouble. I wrote about Yemen some time ago. Yes. And then I wrote about it again. Frank, are you back on?
Yes, I'm back soon, yeah.
Oh, I understand. Do you want to stage it with just a final comment?
Yeah, I mean, I've got another 5 minutes, so I'll stay for 5 minutes. I don't know what happened there, but, you know,
oh, we got disconnected. I kept the conversation going, having no idea if I was on air, because then I heard the music come on while I was talking, thinking that you're disconnected and I'm disconnected too. But take the remaining time you have and comment further on the overall picture of what's happening in the Middle East.
I was saying that what's for me incredible and what's happening in the Middle East and in Maghreb is incredible. Those really dictators in power. Okay, there's been election, but Mubarak's been elected for many years now with about 95% of the vote. So if this was happening anywhere else in the world, everyone, including the U.S., will condemn the election as rigged, but they don't do it when it comes to Mubarak. What's important for me is to also focus on popular resistance. And I think what's been happening in the Arab world, in Tunisia, in Algeria, in Morocco, Egypt, Yemen, there was always a fear factor, a fear of actually, you know, dissent was not tolerated at all. You know, even on the internet, blogs were being shut, the internet was being shut, and there was a strong fear in the population that if I say something wrong about the government, I'll get kidnapped. If I demonstrate, I'll get shot at. And I think what the Tunisian people have proven is that, or they've had enough, and they've said, okay, we'll demonstrate anyway. I know we'll get shot, and a lot of people died in Tunisia. A lot of people died in Egypt right now. There's about 100 at least people have died so far. But they said, okay, we'll lose a few people, but that enough is enough, and we'll demonstrate. And once this barrier, once the fear factor has been broken, and once people are fearless, you can't stop them. And that's what's been happening in all over the place. You cannot stop those people. And I think that's why, I mean, Mubarak has implemented a curfew in Egypt. It hasn't worked. People are still on the street. There's tanks on the street. There's helicopters flying over Tahrir Square. People are still on the street. The fear factor has been broken. People are not, you know, scared anymore. And there's no way back. So there's no way back. There was no way back for Ben Ali, who fell very quickly and was, again, abandoned in 2 days by his puppet masters, France this time. Mubarak will be completely abandoned by the U.S. if he will fall down, you know, and this will continue and will be completely abandoned by the U.S. So the fear factor has been broken, and it's like a snowball rolling all over the Middle East and all over those corrupt regimes, again, propped up by Western corporationists, really, that are the U.S. and the rest. And it's very important. What we've seen in Egypt, they, for example, the mainstream media, maybe not too much in the UK, but in the US, from what I've read, is trying to portray this, and actually the Western states always portraying this as Mubarak, okay, might be a bit of a dictator, but at least he's a moderate, he's not an Islamist, and we don't want the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. What we've seen right now in Tunisia and in Egypt is there's nothing, you know, Islamic about what's happening in the streets. You know, in Egypt you had communist women, you know, standing next to men, you know, all calling together in the same voice for, you know, Mubarak to step down. In Tunisia as well, lots of women were in the streets, lots of young, old communists. And so it's really not, you know, the way the U.S. or the mainstream media wants you to see it. You know, it's not about if Mubarak falls, we're going to have the Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia law, and Islamic State in Egypt. That's not the case at all. What Egyptian wants, it's their human rights, their civil liberties back, a proper government, proper election. You know, they're not calling for anything radical. They're calling for a word overused by people like Bush, etc. They're calling for democracy. And it proves once more that when people have enough, they will overthrow the dictator. It could have happened in Iraq if the U.S. Didn't, you know, colonize the country once again. And it will happen everywhere. You know, the people will overthrow the dictator. They don't need the U.S. to go and so-called, you know, do regime change or anything. The only people that will actually decide on their fate are the people that live in those countries. And what's happening in the Middle East right now could have repercussions all over, I mean, the Middle East. And I know that Israel is really scared of what's happening in Egypt right now. If Mubarak falls, and if someone less U.S. Israeli-friendly comes to power, or if this revolution grabs really hold of a new leader or something, they don't even need a leader. What's going to happen with Gaza? What's going to happen about, you know, the Rafah border? What's going to happen with Egypt's so-called peace deal with Israel? And Egypt is the biggest country of the Middle East. It's a crucial player in Middle East affairs. So I think we're really here for a few very interesting days or very interesting weeks. And it's very exciting. It's actually very exciting even from, you know, sort of comfy London, homes or European homes. It's a very exciting thing. You know, they're really showing us as well the way. You know, they're showing us because our leaders in France, in the US, in the UK are not much better than, you know, than Mubarak and Ben Ali. You know, they're the one that put them there anyway. So they're really showing us the way of popular resistance, civil disobedience, and just a, you know, the best thing about democracy, the will of the people. So yeah, I'll end with this because I'm going to have to go now, Stephen.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank. I'm delighted that I at least got you back to offer some final comments. Let me let you go. We will do this again. probably after the next session. Frank, I'll let you run. I look forward to the report on the next session. And you are a welcome guest on this program anytime.
Fantastic. Have a very good day.
Thank you, Frank. It is interesting, to say the least, what's going on in the Middle East, and there's no question that the machinations are happening behind the scenes in Tel Aviv, in Washington, and in London and other European capitals. And I honest to goodness smell a rat that the old guard is leaving. The old faces are being replaced by new faces. There may be some transitional before something solidified comes in. But Egypt has a very interesting history, too, where oftentimes in the past the unexpected has happened. Mubarak, when Anwar Sadat was assassinated, 1981, I believe, he was an obscure general, never really picked to be the future leader of the country, but he has been for the past 30 years. Nasser came to power the same way. He ruled a lot differently than Mubarak, but Nasser was an obscure colonel, and he came to power. And in my article, I quote someone, a knowledgeable guy, who talks about, there could be a cabal of colonels that nobody really is paying attention to or maybe even knows about. And maybe out of all of this turmoil, they might emerge as the future leaders of Egypt. And whether they'll be Western-friendly or Western-opposed, who can know? Who can tell? So everything is very much up in the air, in the mix. And there may be a lot of Washington plans, the best laid plans, as they say. And what will come out on the other end, we will just have to wait and see. After my new article for tomorrow, I am certain I am not done writing about this. I will stay focused on this like a laser, and as developments warrant, I will keep writing more because it is big, big stuff. And I must say, regardless of Washington's plans, I'm on the side of the Egyptian people and the Tunisians and the Algerians and the Yemenis and the Lebanese and the Palestinians and all of the persecuted people of the world. I support them 100%, including a lot of persecuted Americans. The impoverished and the homeless and the jobless ones are the ones that concern me most. They're my people. Join us again next week. Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern. Weekends, 1 p.m. And we'll always try to bring important guests on to talk about the most cutting-edge topics with in-depth information that everybody needs to know, but you'll never get when you turn on your TV set. And you're not getting it now. You're not getting the true picture on what's going on in the Middle East. It's really cover for what the real plans are. Make us a regular habit.